Hi, I'm John.
And I'm Ron, and this is Digital Divination on the No Direction Network.
All right, welcome to our very first show. So Digital Divinations is a podcast where we tackle a variety of topics related to the Starfinder role-playing game from Paizo. And I, John, will look at things from a player and GM perspective.
And I, Ron, will use the lens of an author and developer and my experience as a player and a GM.
Yeah, and so we're just kind of going to riff back and forth on various topics. And before we get started with that, we'll go ahead and do introductions of ourselves since we're new to the network here, just having joined this last month. And I'll let Ron go first.
Sure. Thank you. New to the network here, but certainly not new to RPGs. I've been writing RPGs for decades now, and I joined Paizo as a developer a couple years back. Right now, I work primarily with the Pathfinder products on the Pathfinder Adventure Path line, concepting those out, assigning them to authors, and then developing the text that comes in. Although in my time at Paizo, I've also tackled a number of other development items, including a couple of Starfinder Society adventures. And then while I work at Paizo during the days, I also do some freelance writing for a lot of different companies, Paizo included. And I've been doing some writing on Starfinder, particularly Starfinder Adventure Paths, which is the things I most enjoy, is telling those adventure stories. The latest one, and it's just been announced, is the end of Dominion's End, which is the highest level Starfinder adventure path we've ever done, and I'm writing the third and final adventure of that. It's a lot of fun. It was crazy to be writing for 18th, 19th, 20th level characters, but I was able to really put my knowledge of the Starfinder game to the test.
Yeah, and I'm actually really excited about that high level one there. So it's interesting. One of the things we're going to talk about today is game balance, and I think it's going to be interesting to actually touch on what the differences between the high level and the low level. So unlike Ron, I don't have an extensive writing resume for Starfinder and RPGs. I have been playing for a long time, probably close to 40 years now. I've probably been playing as long as you've been alive. Is that right, Ron?
I don't know. I'm 46. So it would be hard. I think I came at, I was born the year Dungeons and Dragons was born, generally speaking, 1973.
Yeah, yeah.
So you started from the very, very, very beginning, maybe even playing as long as I have.
So my very first role-playing game was the Dungeons & Dragons basic box. It was a gray box with a red dragon on the front, and it came with the slips of paper instead of dice in order to make your random rolls. So I've been playing for a long time, and I played through a whole bunch of D20 games and some beyond that. I took a break and actually went into online gaming for a while, led some really big guilds over time, and then I decided I missed the companionship of playing with people face to face, and so several years ago I started playing role playing games, tabletop RPGs. And got into playing Starfinder when it first released. And since then, I've been pretty much, that's all I've been doing. I've dabbled a little bit in the Pathfinder and a couple other games. But Starfinder's what I'm really excited about. I really like the kind of the sci-fi fantasy of it. I've GM'd now probably about 500 hours of game. Over 100 tables. And I've played over 500 hours of Starfinder. And, I currently have in society play, which is where most of my play is, I have a level 12, two level 12 characters, a level 11 character, and a level, I think, 8 character, and then a whole bunch of other ones there. And I think I'm like the only person in society play that has more than one level 12 at this point.
Wow.
So, yeah, I've just this combination of GMing playing is really kind of added up a lot of hours and ability to build characters. But because of this, I've done a lot of organizing for Starfinder here locally in the Seattle area. Last year, I went and made the tour of the gaming conventions. I actually went to 8 different conventions across the country, including the big ones at PaizoCon, Origins, and Gen Con. Met lots of really cool people. And that's actually what got me into the podcasting. And now one of the things I've been branching into is actually doing some freelance writing. And so that's where I've been kind of picking Ron's brain a little bit and everybody I interview's brains a little bit on where to go from here. So,
yeah. Although where to go, as you found out, is really sort of hit or miss, right? I mean, there's a lot of people who have everybody has their own unique path into doing this, right? And so nobody else is going to have the same path of doing a bunch of stuff with, you know, Guild Wars, right? Isn't the Guild Wars what you were?
Right.
And then going into Starfinder right off of the bat and then playing, you know, literally 1,000 hours of it. I mean, nobody else is going to have your story. So that's fun. It's fun to think that years from now, somebody will be interviewing you. How'd you get your start, John?
Well, yeah, I don't know. It's interesting when I've talked to other people to hear, you know, some of them say that they had like no experience of the game at all when they came in to work for Paizo and started freelancing and stuff. Others have extensive game experience in the industry and with Pathfinder in particular. So it's a wide range. One of the things I think it's important for us to point out, though, Ron, is what you did before you started becoming a developer, because I think that's very important in how we look at things, or in particular, how you look at things in the game.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Going back even further, I was actually a lawyer for several years. I went to law school at the University of Chicago, worked at a big firm in downtown Chicago for many years, and then went in-house with Walgreens. So I was responsible for a lot of the contracting that was on for healthcare, pharmacies. A lot of that sort of transactional legal work that I did sort of day after day is startlingly similar to game design, right? And writing for games, because the whole point is to use a structured framework of rules and then present it in a way that people on two different sides, whether, you know, two different parties of a contract or GM versus player, see as fair on both sides and can use as their framework to relate with each other going forward. So there's a lot more similarities to my old career as an attorney and my new career as a game designer and developer than I ever would have suspected when I made the switch.
But you're still dabbling in law, from what I can tell, though.
I do. It's actually been a lot of fun, and I try to make sure that I'm keeping my foot in the door and keeping my sort of legal network open. Mm-hmm. I think that there's, you know, it's just as easy to be, you know, sort of moving back and forth. It's just what are the rules you're using, right? Is it a big body of case law established by the courts, or is it a, you know, 600 page core rule book for the Starfinder game?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so about my own background. So when I'm not running games and playing games, which I've probably been doing too much of late, I actually teach. So I'm a university professor. I recently got tenure. I teach business classes, marketing, entrepreneurship, organizational behavior, a variety of things like that. And one of the things I find is that the teaching aspect, how I prepare for class and how I get in there to present material, is a whole lot like how I GM. And in fact, my prep time and my sequence of doing things is almost identical going between the two. So it's really kind of neat.
that's very interesting, especially because you're acting as our GM currently in the Dawn of Flame adventure path, right? You don't ever sit down and say, now I'm going to teach you guys a thing or two, but that's what happens.
Oh yeah. But that's the thing. Even when you're teaching college students, it's less about conveying knowledge and more about how do you entertain them in a way that they magically learn something too. Yeah. So yeah, it's a lot different. You know, I don't think I could actually teach like K-12. It's just kind of a different approach that you have to take. And I've honed now over 18 years teaching at the university level. So it's kind of like that's what I like to do. And I think that's why I kind of really naturally gravitated towards doing a lot of GMing. Even when I first started playing Starfinder, just picking it up, we didn't have anybody to GM. So I said, hey, I'll do it. And that's how I got into doing so many games.
Yeah, there you are. I think that there's actually quite a lot of that sort of skill used whenever you're bringing new people into the game. One thing I've noticed is that it's easier to tell somebody, oh, you want to, you know, climb over that wall. Okay, roll that roundish looking die and add 10 to whatever you get. That's very easy to do, but it is better to be, all right, well, that's athletics. Where's your athletics? How would you make that check? Right. Kind of teaching, having them teach themselves. Right. So,
Yeah. And then prior to becoming an academic, as Ron knows, I spent 11 years in the Coast Guard doing primarily ice breaking and law enforcement, which has come up on occasion as we've been going through some of these APs and.
Wait, the ice breaking or the law enforcement?
Well, more the experience with large ships thing. But we don't need to rehash that now. I actually have talked to some of the designers about that. And so it's interesting. So when I was able to do some writing on the Starship Operations Manual, that's one of the things I tried to be really careful of is that, okay, these ships I'm designing, these are realistic here, given the constraints we have, right? Mm-hmm. So, because that was one of the complaints I had about some of the in the AP that we were running through initially. So, all right, well, today what we want to talk about for a little bit here is game balance, and we're going to talk about balance for characters, for creatures, for encounters, and for equipment. Kind of what that looks like, why we want to do it. How it gets built into a game and how it gets managed by GMs. So I'm going to let Ron actually start here a little bit and talk to us about when you're putting together a system, when you're building out an AP or designing something for players, what does balance look like to you on in that very broad level?
It's a tricky question, right? I think the easiest but probably wrong answer is that what balance is fair, that if you've got players who are trying to complete a goal and the world is trying to push back against that goal, the world as represented by the Game Master is trying to push back that goal, then like a strictly fair analysis would be, all right, well, I'm going to try to climb that wall and half the time I'm going to make it and half the time I won't. Or I'm going to try to hurt this this guy that's trying to, you know, come at me with a big knife and half the time I'm going to hit him, half the time I won't. That would be fair, but it's not correct for a role-playing game because fundamentally we're telling adventure stories about heroes who are doing heroic things. And they ought to win. They ought to win most of the time. And so having everything be strictly, you know, yes, no, maybe fair, but it makes for an incredibly swingy and sometimes very unsatisfying kind of game. I want to drill down on that point a bit. One of the dice that I have in my dice bag that I love as a game master is my yes-no die. It's a six-sided die. I don't know if you've ever seen me break this out, John. It's a six-sided.
I think you've showed us that, yeah.
It's a six-sided die that's got yes on three sides and no on three sides. And I was actually doing a playtest of a Pathfinder Society scenario I wrote. And rather than go through all the rules and have people make characters, I said, all right, we're just going to run the game with the yes-no die, right? And every time you want to fight somebody, the question is, do I hit him? You roll the die. And if the answer was yes, you hit him, then you ask, did I kill him? And then you roll the die. Yes, he's dead. Yeah. Right. And then when the monster attacks you, does the monster hit you? Yes, no. Oh, it hit you. All right. Did the monster kill you? Yes, no. Right. And everything was, you know, oh, does the person give us the information? Oh, no. All right. Well, you know, I guess we try to proceed without it. It was the most strictly fair yet least satisfying game I think I've ever run. But the, you know, maybe there's something to that, sort of the flip of a coin or a yes-no kind of game system in there someplace. But the finessing that it would require, the reason it was unsatisfying is because it didn't lead towards heroes, to the players, feeling challenged, but the heroes succeeding. And really, that's the tricky bit of game balance, is that you don't want to have a demoralizing set of constant or potentially constant failure, but you also don't want to have the dissatisfaction that comes with being just 100% successful all the time. And so striking that balance between this is something that isn't automatic, but isn't impossible, is how you tell the sorts of stories that good sort of fantasy, science fantasy adventures revolve around. That's what I think the ultimate, the goal is, what we're trying to get to in this sort of thing.
Yeah, I agree on that. I mean, that's something, you know, when I think of the encounters that the players remember and talk about, you know, weeks and months, sometimes years after the fact, it's the ones that were very challenging, but they got through. Maybe they got through with some scars. Maybe somebody actually died, but they were able to get through. And it's not the ones that they just kind of walk through. It's not a big deal. You know, it's interesting. So when we talk about CRs quite a bit, or you see CRs in the book all the time. And CR stands for what?
That's challenge rating. That's
challenge rating, yeah. And so the whole idea being that the encounter, or what is being built by the authors, by the developers, and then kind of built, the storytelling built by the GM, is designed to challenge the players, but not defeat the players.
Right. That's a really good way to put it. To put it. To challenge the players, but not to defeat them, if mm-hmm. the challenge rating is set correctly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, how do you do that? So as you're, you know, designing monsters, say, how does that challenge rating equate to kind of the player power or what the players can do?
Well, this is one of the things that's actually really great, really easy about Starfinder, is they've given they've done a lot of the work for you, I guess. When it comes to monsters specifically, the designers have done an awful lot of the work. They say, if you're going to be a group of players and you're going to be fighting something, if all your players are fourth level, then that is a challenge rating of 4, a fourth level monster, or a challenge rating 4 monster, should be just about enough to give the heroes a little bit of pause, right? It's not going to be a pushover for them, but they ought to come out okay most of the time. And so when you've got a challenge rating of a monster that is the same as the party level, the average level of the players, which for most campaigns, most of the time, is just the same level. It's only an organized play, I think, is it unusual to have a real broad variety. Most of the time, it's like, all right, well, everybody's 10th level, let's play. And so from there, it skews a little bit up or down, right? If you've got a monster with a challenge rating that's 1 less than your party's average level, that's going to be a lot easier for them. 1 more is going to be a little bit harder. 2 more would be even harder than that. And you get up to 3 or 4 more, it's going to be, could be impossibly hard. Certainly people are going to be having to pull out, the players are going to have to be pulling out all the stops. And, you know, some of them might not even make it. Then you can balance that with how you design for multiple creatures. If you've got our fourth level party, you've got a single challenge rating 4 creature is going to be, they're kind of a good challenge. You know, you can give them several of those in a day before they have to stop and, you know, rest and get their resolve back and so on. But if you've got a challenge rating of 2 for that fourth level party, 1 of them is not going to be a big deal, but 2 of them will be about right. If you've got a challenge rating of 1, then 3 of them will be about right. So on. So it actually kind of scales to have multiple monsters as well. So that's what the challenge rating kind of with monsters lets you do, is pick, all right, what's good for this to give my players the kind of challenge I want.
Now, does this presume a couple things? 1, does it presume a balanced party? And does it presume a well-made character, an average character, an optimized character, or a below optimal character? Does that matter as much? Or is that challenge rating kind of squishy enough that it encompasses all of that, do you think?
It's gonna be squishy, and it kind of has to be squishy because monsters come in all sorts of different types, right? Mm-hmm. And a type of monster that is just flinging a lot of spells that require will saves, you know, suddenly characters that are great at killing stuff and great at fortitude saves and are big and beefy are finding themselves a little bit, you're really tested by that. And so I think the assumption is that it's going to be for a party of 4 characters, and that it's going to be a party of 4 characters that basically have all their bases covered. Maybe not necessarily every single skill, maybe not a strict uniformity of you've got the goodwill save, you've got the good reflex save, you've got the good fortitude save. But people that are, the party as a whole is sort of generally well-built enough. And I think that there's less of a concern about that around most home games. There's a real concern about that in a lot of organized play, right? When you sit down at an organized play table, you don't know what you're going to get. It could be you're like, oh, well, I guess I'm bringing my Skittermander Envoy to a table of four other Skittermander Envoys, right? This does not have the sort of balance that the game designers intended.
Well, it's funny that you mentioned that example, because yesterday I played in a society game, which is our local group, but we played online, and I was really wanting to play my Envoy. I had a 10th level Envoy that needed one more game to get to 11, and so did somebody else. And then Scott had his Envoy. He hasn't played for much, very much in the last couple months. So we had a group with three Envoys. And although it was not challenging to get through encounters, man, it made encounters go a really long time ago. We couldn't kill anything.
No, everybody's looking for somebody else to be the one to dish out all the damage.
Yeah, who's the tank? It's like, you know, now, and then we had two operatives, right?
So I was about to ask if you had anybody who could do the damage, and if operative is yes, the answer is yes.
Yeah, so I thought that was going to be okay, but it was really funny having such a skewed group like this, not having a very balanced group, you know, where you have a tank and a caster and all this kind of stuff, you know, envoys and operatives. I thought, man, this is going to be a great group. We're going to blow through everything. And it was like, that was like one of the longest society games I've played in a long time because we were all trying to support them. And if they missed, they just missed. And it's like, oh, we're not doing much damage.
No, we can't do it. Well, and that's the kind of thing that just doesn't often happen in a home game, right? Because you come and you say, I want to play my envoy, and everybody else is like, well, I was kind of thinking about playing an envoy too, but gosh, if you want to play one, then I'm going to go ahead and play a soldier, right? That's sort of my second choice, and I think I can have fun with that. Somebody was like, no, I got this mystic build I'm trying to think of. And people will work that out in their game. And I think that a lot of the design of Starfinder assumes that people have kind of worked that out. And so that's why you're seeing kind of an edge case of, here's just a bunch of envoys having a lot more trouble than I think the game assumes that that groups of players are going to have.
Mm-hmm. I mean, at least we were three kind of different types of envoys, so it wasn't like 100% overlapping skills, but it was still like, man, this is normally I'm like, I'll play something else, but I really wanted that last scenario and to move up to 11th level with my envoy. So it's like, so talking about individual character building, you know, so we're building a character in trying to decide how it's going to go. This is something in our actual play that, you know, we kind of talk about a little bit as we're going along. But when you design a character, do you have a sense for how it's going to be when you're done playing it at the beginning? Like, do you map out ahead of time how this build's going to go? Or do you just kind of like, whatever I feel like next level I'll do?
Oh, I am totally the latter. I am totally, all right, what does it sound like my character would do, what would be fun for me, how would that go, which is why in the Dawn of Flame game, I've got that that little squawks that follows me around, because I've taken all the squawks feats just because I thought, oh, that's kind of fun to have a little critter, and oh, I've got feats I can take that have the little critter do stuff in combat, oh, I'm going to take those, right? That's certainly nothing I planned on from the very beginning. I'm not even necessarily committed to playing the same class all the way through, but the game is built, I think, well enough so that if you're a member of a class, you're looking at what you get when you level up. You're like, ooh, that's pretty good. Some dipping into a multi-class is going to have to be pretty, pretty awesome to tempt me away from having my trick attack go up from 1d8 to 3d8, right, as an example. So I think that I'm less likely to multi-class just because classes have kind of fun stuff at virtually every level. And so I usually stay with the one I picked from the beginning, but it's certainly not because I planned to. How about yourself? How do you go?
Yeah, I'm kind of maybe a little bit more the opposite of that. One of the games I played when I played online games was Neverwinter Nights by BioWare. I don't know if you're familiar with it. Basically, it allows you to build characters based on the 3.5 rule set and play them in a video game. And I had this persistent world that I played on with a bunch of people. I literally would make characters after character and level them up. And I would spell out, you know, all the feats I would take, the level I would take them at, all the ability points I would allocate at each level. And I would just go try to build. I would have a certain build in mind, and I'd see, okay, how can I optimize this build? And I did that for probably about 50 characters going through it. And the thing is, you actually had to play them to get experience and level them up. So this was a big time commitment that I had here. But it was, for me, it was kind of fun. You know, like somebody would say, oh yeah, I get a build for, you know, a cleric build with implosion that can basically destroy any creature on the whole server. I said, oh, I want to try that. How do you do that? You know, trying to figure it out. Or, well, I could build a ranger that could not be hit by any creature on the server. Oh, well, let's see how you do that. And so that's kind of my mindset when I came into playing Starfinder. Well, let me design a character how I wanted to go from the beginning to the end, just to see the path I want to take. And so I typically have laid out all the feats I want to take going forward for whatever character I built. Now, I did that in the beginning. It's like the first character of each class I built, I kind of do that way. But now that I have multiples in each classes, now I just kind of do the way you're talking about. Oh, what's fun? I'm just going to start trying different things. And this was probably one of the cool things about going to different conventions is you see all the cool things that people do with different characters that I would never have thought of, you know?
Yep. I was the same early on in the first days of Living Greyhawk in the third edition. I went to an interactive at a convention where there was a big joust and somebody was a wizard who had strapped on plate mail and was just casting True Strike. I'm like, you can't even do that, right? You're casting a spell in armor. Like, wait, True Strike doesn't have a somatic or material component. You can cast that in armor. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's kind of genius. Anyway, I remember being really impressed. So yeah, I love those experiences where you see what other people are doing. One of the things, to bring this back to Starfinder, one of the things that I think I can probably guess is that in all your builds like this, with your end goal in mind, that you probably don't have a lot of time from first level up to that character where you're way up to that level that you sort of looked at the way your build ought to go. You probably don't have an awful lot of time where your character is just no fun to play. I think Starfinder's got things pretty well curved, so it's fun all the time.
Yeah, that's actually, I'll say that's yes and no. Okay. And one of the things I find out, one of the first characters I made playing was an operative in their Dead Sons game. So I played that in campaign mode. That was a lot of fun. But my first society character I played was a soldier. And that's actually, they're both my highest level characters. I have a 12 operative and a 12 soldier in society play now.
Oh, okay.
Now, the thing with a 12 soldier is that if there's not something to hit, that character has nothing to do. Because it is so, you know, everybody else so outstrips him in terms of skills that he can't, okay, I'll assist with that. I can assist a little bit. That's about it. So, you know, any scenario that there's a lot of role-playing going on that doesn't involve hitting stuff, and he's just kind of like, he's just kind of the quiet, stoic type that waits for something to hit. That's about it, you know?
I see. Yeah, that's more of a soldier problem than a specific type, because you didn't get to a point where your soldier can then suddenly contribute to all of the skills.
Right. Now he does have some really neat combinations of skills, which is kind of what I like about him. But it's like, that's one of the things I like about other classes where, and one of the things we should talk about is actually our favorite classes here before we go. That's one of the things I like about other classes that have more skill sets or more skill points allocated per level, because you can just do a lot more in game. And the way so many of the adventure paths and the scenarios are designed, although there'll be several combat encounters in there, there's always interspersed are skill encounters where you have to figure out how to solve a problem and you can't just hit it. I mean, you can, but that's usually not the best way to solve it.
The wrong way or the hard way. Yeah.
So anyway, before we kind of continue on with things, Do you have any concluding remarks about balance?
No, I think that I did want to circle back earlier that I'd said that Starfinder makes it really easy when it would come to monsters specifically for balancing. Oh, mm-hmm. Because right in the back of the Alien Archive, they've got several pages of charts, which are initially intimidating looking. What they function as is just to provide you, here's the baseline for building this kind of monster. You want a combat monster that's CR4? All right, here's all the basic stats you need. You still have to have the flavor and special abilities and kind of the things that make it alive on the table. But you don't need to worry about, what should my attack bonus be to challenge my players? How much damage should I do to challenge my players? That's all part of the charts. And I think that's been really freeing when it comes mm-hmm. to having the design that is really baked into the system.
I like that for monster design, especially if you want to say you want to build a spellcaster, it has a chart for that. You want to build a ranged combat or a melee combat. You have charts that kind of lay out how those things would look in terms of different abilities, special abilities, different attack rolls, and things like that. And I think that makes it a little bit easier on a GM who's homebrewing or coming up with new monsters for a game to work with the system for sure.
Yeah, and I do want to say there's actually a secret kind of buried in there too, buried in the rules. There, if you think, all right, well, other than monsters, how on earth do I know what's right or reasonable for the challenge that I want to do? They want to, shoot that sort of hanging computer panel that sort of runs the whole base that's full of challenge rating 8 people. How much damage should it take to do that? What should the armor class of that dangling computer panel B, there is actually the hack that you can use is to look up the section in the rule book on traps in the core rule book, page 412. I've actually got flagged because I use it so often. It's got a chart that tells you, look, if you're building a trap of certain CRs, what kind of save DC should it have? What should attack bonus be? What should its EAC and KAC be? And it's stuff like that. That actually is a good general statement for just about anything you want to do, right? Oh, you're going to avoid falling into some, off this walkway into lava or something like that. All right, well, what should the save DC be? Well, it seemed like challenge rating 5 for me. This chart says that should be 15. All right, are you going to make a reflex save DC 15 or you fall in? It's actually a really good shorthand for anybody who's doing stuff on, not just stuff on the fly, but actually kind of building things from the ground up to get that. To get what's fair.
No, I like that. I had not thought about that. I have used DCs. Basically, I try to find something similar, comparable DC someplace else. I did not know about that resource. That's a really good thing to point out.
Yeah, it's good. It actually makes preparing stuff kind of quick too, because you don't need to spend all the time thinking about what does that be? What is that like? Maybe it's like the Cosmic Eddy spell, and that's this kind of damage and so on. You can just kind of look across and say, you know what? It does 6d12 fire damage there. Ouch. All right, moving on.
All right, so we're probably going to take a deeper dive into a lot of these specifics here in future shows. We just kind of wanted to hit a kind of high level talk about game balance, do some introduction here. Now, there were some questions that were posted by fans on our Discord and also on our Patreon site. Now, some of these were for Lewis and Lauren's podcast, but I think they're applicable for ours. And so the first of these questions was, should the GM assume that every low-level PC are greatly above average when it comes to abilities versus the average population? And if so, how do you effectively communicate this to a party?
That's a good question.
I think you already answered the first part of this, in that our players are heroes.
Yep. And they ought to feel like it, right? I think that even if you don't have a, NPCs that you pass sort of, throwing confetti in front of you as you go to feel like a hero necessarily, you ought to know that you're like the main character. Like, yeah, you ought to feel like you're the protagonists in this story.
Well, I think in how other people interact with you, how the NPCs interact with you, the kind of the setup for, where you live, how you're doing things, type of equipment you have, how you dress. I mean, there's a lot of things that you'll do that will set you apart from your average citizen. And I think a lot of that we take for granted as players and as GMs. you know, we go marching into the city wearing our full battle gear and all our armor and weapons, right? So that's not unusual. Maybe it is. Maybe it is. Maybe people look at you one way or the other. So I think that's, you know, I think we gloss over that, but I think it is important maybe to note that as a GM, as you're kind of setting it up for the players to show that even as first level adventurers, you are something special.
Yeah. One of the things that I like to think about that is even, I mean, this isn't really a Western genre, but I think about Westerns when I'm doing even, you know, Pathfinder, Starfinder, anything else. In the stories that of Westerns, the people are coming to town, the heroes themselves are coming to town, and they're there to handle problems that the other people in town can't solve. And it's maybe it's not that the bartender in the saloon doesn't have a sawed-off shotgun. He probably does, tucked there under the counter. But he's constrained by sort of the life that he leads in the society, right? He's got to go to work every day. He's got to deal with all these people. He's got to look them in the face on the streets. And the thing that's really empowering about being a hero in a Western is, look, we're going to come in, and we're going to kind of not care who likes us or not. We're just going to get the job done. Maybe we get some accolades for it, but then we're moving on to the next thing, right? And that's the being so free to be able to just go in and get the problem done without having to go back to work the next day or something like that is what really distinguishes, I think, a lot of player characters from non-player characters. I try to play that up and let people know, you know, look, you know, I got to deal with these, my wife's, you know, cousin is the guard here. So I'm certainly going to hear about it from home if I do anything about it, but hey, you heroes, hey, you can go do that. Sneak past those guys. So that's one way to distinguish people, make them distinguish the heroes, make them feel different, special, more heroic.
No, I like that. I think that's a good perspective. All right. So the next question is, a specialist or a generalist better? Will a generalist still be able to contribute well enough at higher levels? And I think this is an interesting one, given your AP where you've written basically the was it 18 to 20?
Yeah, 18 to 20.
You know,
and I think you can probably start mentioning to people now that I actually did, in the course of writing this, playtested a big chunk of it at 18th level. And John, with you. So,
okay, I wasn't sure if we were allowed to talk about that. Okay.
Yeah, let's do. Let's say.
Okay.
So what I did is we had all the people that were in our standard Dawn of Flame game. I think we were, what, like just fourth or fifth level at the time? I'm like, hey, level everybody up to 18th level.
And and that was hard work. It was hard to level up to 18th level.
It was. There's a lot of choices that you don't realize. You don't ever think about making because you've never made a character that high, right?
Right.
So there became some pretty obvious gaps, right? Some people kind of knew, well, you get as much, you can get an awful lot of resistance to a lot of types of damage or DR. And other people were like, oh, I didn't know you could get that via armor upgrades or cyberware or whatever.
Well, so I was playing my operative for that. And the interesting thing that I noticed with that is basically everything except for mysticism, I had maxed out skill points for, skill ranks.
Yep.
And so when you talk about generalist versus specialist, the operative is a generalist that does really well compared to any specialist at high level in terms of skills. Now, in terms of damage output, it was well behind the soldier and Solarian, I think.
Right, you know, yeah.
It does good at medium levels, but high levels, that starts to taper off, and those two start to take off quite a bit. I think in terms of this question, I think that both of them can be successful at high levels. I think that a generalist is actually a little bit more fun to play up to that level than it is to, you know, if you just magically became high level as a specialist and then you could do all your special stuff, that might be okay, you know, but getting up there, you're missing out on maybe 2/3 of what's going on because you're just not, you can't do any of it, you know?
Yeah, I think that's right. Or maybe more than 2/3, yeah. Depending on how laser focused specialized you are. And it's also noticeable that when you've got the same specialist, if you're a specialist and your specialization is the same as somebody else's, That just doesn't mm-hmm. feel very good, right? If you're like, I'm the guy who can totally intimidate everybody, like, oh, and so are you. All right, well, that makes you feel less unique. And so for that way, I think I lean towards generalist as the better answer here, if only because that lets you participate more often and excel in your own way a lot more often. If you're able to excel at several things instead of being auto win at just one, I think that feels better in play.
Mm-hmm. And I think at high levels that a generalist will be okay. You know, what ends up happening with a specialist is they just have some astronomically high roles in their specialization that they basically don't fail like any DCs. So that specialist will beat all the DCs. And so then if you have a specialist for everything that you do, then basically your team auto wins all the DCs. And that challenge, even though it's a high level challenge, is not as challenging as it could be if you're all generalists.
Yeah. I remember complaining after I was turning back after we'd playtested this chunk to go in and kind of grouse into some of the people that are in the sky people, right? Which is what we Pathfinder people call the Starfinder workers, right? Those developers are the sky people. Complaining to them like, man, I really wish there was a way to code into our game. The difficulty of this check is 38, unless you've got an operative at your table, in which case the freaking DC is 48.
Yeah, well, it's going to be interesting. Like when you mentioned Jason Tondreau when he was going to be GMing Book 6 of our AP, saying that we're going to need two operatives in our game. So, you know.
Yeah, I'm excited about that. I mean, he said, no holds barred. We'll see. We'll see if I still feel the same way about challenge versus balance and all that.
Yeah. No, I hope it's very, very challenging. I think it'd be a lot of fun if it is. So the last question that we had, and this was specifically for us, was from Timothy Hager. And his question is, what is your favorite Pact World class and core race? And
I'll go first.
Okay, go ahead.
My favorite Pact World definitely is Auktern. And I actually got to write some of the chunks of the Pact World's book. And they ended up circling back to me because I got everything done kind of early and done well. And they're like, hey, we still have some of this book to assign. There's somebody at the last minute couldn't do. And one of them is Auktern. I'm like, wait, really? Really? I get to write the sort of the evil Lovecraftian planet? Oh, totally. Mm. So I was very excited to build that out. That's been one of my favorite writing assignments that I've done since I've been at Paizo, is being able to sort of put some life and some extra layers of creepiness as much as I could layer on into Auktern. I think that it just sort of feels like a place for high level weird play. And I love that there's a place in that, this place for that in the setting.
How about you? What about class and core race?
Oh, class and core race. I'm a big fan of envoys just because I like being the sort of helper around the table and being the one who sort of is given the license to talk and negotiate with people, right? Mm-hmm. Whenever you're interacting and role-playing, people kind of, even if they don't realize they're doing it, right? Their eyes will turn to whoever's playing the envoy or the bard or whatever the negotiating type character is. And so the dynamic around the table is people who play those kinds of characters are given the license to engage the most in that type of play. I like that type of play. And so I like envoys because they let me sort of be up there in front and talking. When we were doing the Dead Sons adventure path, I mean, there were plenty of times when I didn't have any idea. I was playing an envoy. I had no idea what was going on, but people were like, oh, what's the envoy going to say? I'm like, I'll just make something up.
You were also our frontliner, though, so I don't know.
Not intentionally. But as far as race goes, I'm a big fan. I've always been sort of a big fan of humans, right? I think that there is a lot of escapism that goes into role-playing games. And for a lot of people, being a race that's entirely non-human is a fun part of that escapism. And I think that's the case for me too. But I like thinking that most of the galaxy or the world is human and interacting with people sort of as they are. Humans are very rarely ever going to be, you know, oh, who let that thing in here? Oh, we don't serve your kind here. And that lets you, like I say, going back to my Envoy answer, right? That lets you engage a lot more often than you otherwise might if you wanted to be a, you know, a Bantriot or an SRO or something unusual like that.
Yeah, I don't have as good of a story for the Pack World, favorite Pack World as you do, but mine's kind of related. It's Castrovel, and primarily for some of the things I wrote for the Starship Operation Manual, I had to reference things that happened on Castrovel. And so I really got to take a deep dive into some of their history and some of the different parts of it and kind of the warring factions there with the Formians and the relationship with the elves and things like that and the Shuntas and whatnot. So I found that to be really interesting and was able to craft some of that into some of the things I wrote up and backstory and things.
Oh, that's really cool.
Yeah. So that's kind of for that. And for class, for me, hands down is the operative, but it's not for the reason that maybe most people might think, other than it's more, I've always loved playing Rangers.
Really?
Ranger is my favorite class. And I love playing characters that can attack at range, get up close, can be stealthy and sneaky. And the operative really fit the bill on a lot of that. Though the way we play operatives does not really play a lot. We play Rangers. But that's kind of the reason why I like the operative is a lot. And the neat thing about it is there's a lot of different flavors of operatives too, which, you know, I was not aware of when I first started building things. And now to see, like, you know, you have your what's the survivalist one? What's it called?
Explorer, I think.
The Explorer. Yeah, that's really neat. You know, for that, I build a Daredevil, which I think is cool. And then there's one, I don't know if it's a detective, the one that uses bluff for a trick attack. It's like, cool is that? You know, so there's a lot of range and what you can do with an operative. And so I kind of like that. And then Core Race, you know, I've always been a fan of synthetic humans. So like replicants or however you want to call them. And so I like androids and kind of how they kind of fit into that mold there in terms of something that looks similar to human, but isn't quite there, has some, you know, differential abilities, does get some negative bias against them in a lot of places because they don't quite fit in well or they do things too well compared to others, things like that.
That actually makes a lot of sense when you talk about how much you like Rangers going into operatives, because Rangers sort of, the archetypal Ranger sort of stands at the edge of civilization and is a, you know, protector and explorer of civilization, but is by their very essence kind of an outsider to everybody else. And I can see how an android fits that sort of theme as well.
Yeah, so that's kind of like, that's kind of what I like about him. So, well, I think we're at our time here for this. So we're going to go ahead and wrap up. So, Ron, it's been great chatting with you.
Oh, this has been a lot of fun.
So we're going to be doing these every other week. So it'll be another 2 weeks that we'll have this out. And we're scheduling these for release on Tuesday morning. So look for these on the No Direction Network on Tuesdays.
Yeah, we should also say that we don't have a very strong sense of where to go or what to do next. We can talk about any number of things, but what we really want to be talking about is what people want to hear. Mm-hmm. So absolutely on the, on the channels, let us know. This is, you know, hey, you know, give us a, discussion about X or Y or, you know, I've got a real questions about Z. I mean, that's, we can go into any of this and we'd love to hear what people want us to hear us talk about.
Yeah, for sure. You know, we'll probably bring a topic, but we'll be open to pretty much anything as we're going out. Yep. I think that's a good point.
Alrighty.
All right. Have a good night, Ron. Take care.
Thanks so much, John. You too. All right. Good night.